Hello, it's Scott Manley here. It's Friday the 13th once again, and I'm recording another batch of Deep Space updates. We've had a whole lot of updates to Artemis, as you might have heard. Well, I'm going to go over those in a lot of detail, but that wasn't the only news that's happened in the last week or so. But let's start with the launches. So we've had five Starlink launches in the last few couple of weeks. We've had two from Slick 40 on the East Coast on February 27th and March 4th. And at Vandenberg, we've had Starlink launches on March 1st, 8th and 13th. First thing this morning, I looked for it, I could not see it. But going over to Japan, Space One attempted to launch their Kairos rocket for the third time. We were getting hopeful. This is a small sat launch vehicle which has had two previous failures, although each one got slightly further. This one was to carry five CubeSats, four from Japan, one from Taiwan. And unfortunately, it was a failure again. So let's rewind. The first Kairos launch, you might remember, it was pretty spectacular. It took off, and a few seconds after launch, the flight termination system kicked in, creating a giant fireball just off the launch pad. The second launch, it actually got a lot further, but it then had problems with inertial measurement systems, and it began to lose control, spiral out of control, and the flight termination system activated. And on this one, we've had an update from Space One, who tells us that the launch was going perfectly. There were no anomalies. All the numbers were showing exactly the right numbers until the flight termination system activated for some unknown reason. So this flight termination system seems very eager, and unfortunately, I don't know if Kairos is going to launch again. You know, Space One doesn't look like they're in the best financial position. They have a lot of sponsors on their launch pad and everything, but I kind of hope that we see more launches from them, because it would always be a shame to see people stop doing what they clearly like to do. Anyway, also on March 5th, down in New Zealand, we had Rocket Lab with a flight called Insight at Speed is a Friend Indeed. And this is a dedicated Electron launch for a confidential commercial customer. We are pretty sure that confidential commercial customer is Black Sky. They run a constellation of low Earth orbit high resolution imaging satellite. In fact, they posted a very cool high resolution image of an airport just to show the quality of imagery they get from this. It's not guaranteed at this point, but we're pretty sure that was who involved. This launch was, of course, successful. On March 10th, SpaceX launched a Falcon 9 carrying EchoStar 25, or XXV if you speak Roman numerals. This is a geostationary communications satellite carrying TV, broadband services, launched out of the East Coast, Slick 40, Cape Canaveral, and of course launched it into a geostationary transfer orbit. Apparently this is one of the heaviest payloads that's ever gone to GTO on a Falcon 9. It went up to, it was 15,000 pounds, or about 7 tons if you speak metric. The booster was recovered and the upper stage deorbited. This was a successful mission. March 11th, in Vandenberg, we'd been waiting for this one for a while. There were a lot of false starts, but Firefly made the final launch of their Alpha Block 1 Stairway to 7. This was carrying a payload for Lockheed Martin ICOR SV, which went into a retrograde low Earth orbit heading out over the Pacific. Now, we'd had multiple launch windows which ended up getting cancelled or scrubbed, and Wednesday it finally went, and it seemed to be a successful flight out of Vandenberg, Slick 2. This was, of course, their return to flight after an anomaly in 2025, where a higher angle of attack had led to more gases, hot gases, impinging on the side of the rocket, which had weakened the first stage, which then exploded during stage separation and meant that they lost the nozzle. But that is going to be the final launch of the Block 1 version of the Alpha. They have a Block 2 configuration in the works, which is going to be 7 feet longer, basically tank stretch. It's going to have improved like batteries and avionics, enhanced thermal protection system. And I'm not sure when that is debuting, but I hope to see it flying sooner rather than later. March 12th saw two launches out of China. First, we had a Long March 8A, which was carrying 9 Guowang satellites. That is the equivalent of China's Starlink, or at least it's one of their versions of Starlink. We don't know what's really going to end up winning, but they've certainly launched more satellites into that constellation than any of the others. Later in the day, we had a Long March 2D launching out of Xichang, carrying a satellite called Xi'an 30, 3 and 4. We don't know what this is. Again, the official word is Earth Observation Technological Testing and Validation Purposes. It's a something. It's doing secret military investigation, experimental stuff that they don't necessarily want to tell us about. But yeah, this is, you know, this has been a success as far as we know. The other suborbital launch, which I want to talk about, in fact, I had was centerpiece for a whole video, was Rocket Lab's Haste flight, which of course took off out of Wallops on the East Coast. That's not a knife. That is a hypersonic scramjet. It was the DART AE spacecraft, or aircraft, let's say, which was launched up to high Mach numbers with the scramjet that was built by an Australian company called Hypersonics using 3D printing. It was actually part of the Defence Innovation Unit mission called Cassowary Vex. It's not clear if there was anything else involved there. We don't know what happened after the fairing separated, but we do know that the flight was considered a success. And I have a whole video on scramjet technology, you know, somewhere. There'll be a link, right? But the other suborbital launches we've been seeing a lot of in the last couple of weeks has been ballistic missiles launching in the Middle East. Yeah, there is another war going on. US, Israel basically striking targets in Iran. Iran basically striking targets all over the Middle East. Primarily ballistic missiles from Iran, but there's a lot of drones and things like that. One space-related consequence of this is that a lot of the imaging providers like Planet, Black Sky, etc., are putting delays on their imagery from that region. Obviously, this is a security thing for to stop Iran and its allies looking up locations of US military assets and whatever, but also it makes it hard for Western journalists to actually look and confirm stories that are coming out of the region regarding things that have been struck, destroyed, or whatever. We have seen images, unfortunately, of F-14s getting destroyed on the ground, which is sad. Sometimes people ask me how I know all this stuff about rockets and stuff. And look, the truth is that after getting a degree in physics, it's all been stuff that I read about on the internet, because you can find almost anything out there, including lots of personal information you may not want to have out there. And while I love to learn everything about spaceflight, there are businesses who make it their goal to learn everything about you. Why, I hear you say, because you can understand why people would be super interested in learning about moon rockets but think it's weird that there's a literal business that makes money learning about you. Those are data brokers collecting bits of information about everyone from social media, public records, and the occasional questionable data leak, then joining it all together into a detailed personal profile with your address, phone numbers, even driver's license, and bundling it up to be sold to buyers. And I'm not sure the buyers or sellers in this market have your best interests at heart. This personal information is ripe for misuse. There's been cases of identity theft that were facilitated using data acquired from these data broker servers. It's a pain to clean up the results, so it's better to take steps to prevent it. And so, our sponsor, Incogni, offers a way to protect yourself from this kind of data sharing, where they will get those data dealing websites to delete your data. There are laws that protect you from this kind of thing, but it takes a lot of effort to do it yourself. Incogni simplifies and streamlines the removal process with a fully automated system dedicated to the task of keeping your personal data personal. Getting started is easy, and after creating an account, it uses your information to check with known data brokers and identify matching records. There will be lots. So many, in fact, that you'll be glad that you just have to click one button to give Incogni permission to send out legal takedown letters on your behalf, scrubbing your secrets from the internet. This service isn't just limited to Incogni's extensive list of known data brokers. They offer a custom removal tool that will take the necessary steps to request removal from sites like news portals, sports publications, or health apps. The internet is a big place. Take back your personal data with Incogni. Use code MANLY at the link in the description to get 60% off an annual plan. And now, back to the video. Anyway, the big news, yeah, it's all SLS, right? Well, this is going to be a lot of the stuff we talk about. First of all, yes, we had the big news yesterday that SLS has been taken back. It is cleared for flight. It's going to roll out to the pad again. The aim is to take off in the launch window at the start of April from the 1st through the 7th. I believe they added a new launch window there, I think on the 2nd. So that has been confirmed. It looks like it's on schedule for now. No guarantee that it's going to go. We all know this is a big, complicated thing, but there are people on board, so you want to make sure things are extra, extra high quality. NASA also announced as part of this flight that there's going to be a website which will let you track the spacecraft. So you'll not only be able to use like an AR app on your phone to find it, apparently you can get the right ascension and declination and plug it into your smart telescope and you'll see a tiny dot of light moving over there. So yes, you can actually track the spacecraft on the way to the moon, although given that it is going to be heading towards like a new moon, it's going to be hard. You might have to do this right around sunrise or sunset. Regardless, pay attention to that because it's possibly going in a couple of weeks. The other news that we sort of, that we confirmed our suspicions. So last time we were on, there was this big press conference about how there were big changes to Artemis. And if you didn't catch that, basically Artemis 3 is being switched up to being a low Earth orbit mission where the spacecraft is going to rendezvous ideally with both HLS systems. It's going to come forward, it's going to happen in 2027. Not clear if either of the HLS systems are going to be ready by that point, but, you know, they want to make the cadence of these launches go forwards. Anyway, as part of that, there was a big infographic published, and we saw that there were changes to the second stage on SLS going forwards. It pretty much matched the size of a Centaur V from Vulcan, and this was actually confirmed by a NASA contract, which has been sole-sourced to ULA, basically for reasons of getting things done quickly. So from basically launch 4, Artemis 4 onwards, they're going to be using the Centaur V upper stage. And also, this means that the exploration upper stage is cancelled. And presumably, this also means that the extra launch tower that they had been building with all the swiftness of a glacier is not going to get finished at this point. So Centaur V, it will have about twice the propellant of the ICPS, and the Delta V will be more than enough to get the Orion stack to the moon. In fact, it's right on the border of being able to get it not only to the moon, but also to inject it into low lunar orbit. However, that would require that the Centaur be able to have enough hydrogen and stop it boiling off over that 4-day flight. And while they've talked about long duration operations on the Centaur V, it's not clear that that is actually going to be available for this. Regardless, this will massively increase the capabilities of this. Now, they're not just swapping out the stage. You know, rockets aren't like Kerbal Space Program. They're going to make some changes. First of all, there is a stage adapter between the booster core and the ICPS. Now that's longer, it's going to have to be shorter now. They're going to have to find a completely new builder for this, a new design. There was a different stage adapter which was being made for the exploration upper stage. That's obviously stopped working. And there's also a stage adapter between the Centaur and the Orion stack, and that has to have space for the various CubeSats. So that's going to have to get built. Finally, someone's going to have to adjust the tower so that the umbilicals and stuff are in the correct place for Centaur. And so another big mystery is that since Artemis 3 is now going to low Earth orbit, that is going to leave them with a very capable ICPS, right? The Intracryum Cryogenic Propulsion Stage is basically not needed. It'll have to do a small amount of circularization, but that's going to leave it pretty much 100% full of fuel, and it can have some CubeSats sitting on top of it. What will be the mission that they do with this? I did the math, and this thing has probably over 8 kilometers per second of delta V. It could go directly to interstellar space with like CubeSats on board. It could go to Jupiter. It could get anywhere in the solar system. But CubeSats, they kind of aren't really the greatest thing for that because they have a limited power and thermal capabilities. They're certainly not going to get any radioisotope thermoelectric generators. So yes, we could go to like one of the outer planets, but we're not going to. Also, based on the flight potentially being in early 2027, there's not really any planets in a good location. So I think most likely we're going to see some asteroid missions, if I was to make a prediction. In fact, if I was to make a prediction, I think they might get the Janus spacecraft out of storage since they didn't have a ride. Now they have a ride that can take them to any asteroid they want to. And it might make sense for them to ride on this, as long as they fix the software, because we know that they had the same software bug that killed Lunar Trailblazer. There might be other options, but that's just something I noticed. Now, of course, all these changes, a lot of people heard about these exciting changes coming down to the pipeline. Yes, we're finally going to rationalize SLS, which has, of course, been forced on NASA by Congress, right? I bet everyone's like, wait, no, they can't just do that because Congress has written the exploration upper stage into the law. They have to build it. They have to build all this other stuff. They have to build the gateway. Well, turns out that currently there's a NASA authorization bill running through Congress with Ted Cruz and Maria Cantwell, etc., working on it. And there's been a whole bunch of changes. Clearly, Jared has gone to these people and is trying to get them on board. Now, it's basically the language says things like, since the upper stage is not going to be useful, try to find alternative technology and we'll support that, since it's unlikely to achieve the mission goals of the Artemis campaign. There's another big bombshell in there. As soon as practical, the administrator shall undertake activities necessary to establish a lunar surface moon base, right? Yeah, forget about Gateway. Forget about a presence on the moon or in the vicinity of the moon. This is a moon base, long duration, habitation, robotic, industrial operations to advance science, technology, and strategic interests. I am on board with this, right? The Gateway is, we probably think the Gateway is dead. We think that some of the hardware might be repurposed, but a lunar base, that does make a lot more sense. So looking forward to seeing this actually come down the pipeline and actually have some concrete activity on it. I've said that, like, the race to the moon isn't about who gets there next, right? It doesn't matter, honestly, if the next landing with humans on it is China. What matters is the next 10 landings, right? The cadence, going and keep on going. Because that's how you establish, your presence, human presence. And that's really what we want to see. And speaking about continuous human presence off Earth, there's also some changes to ISS succession plans, or at least language around them, because the commercial stations haven't been sort of progressing as quickly as we would like. And part of that is because Congress hasn't been funding it as well as they should. But Congress has now put in some language which basically says you have to have 6 months between a commercial station getting into orbit and beginning operations before NASA can retire the ISS. And I think that then also comes with a potential 2-year life extension to 2032 of the ISS. And by the way, fascinating piece of news at the ISS in the last couple of weeks was the environmental control team announced that they had now recycled 100,000 pounds of wastewater, which is impressive, right? 100,000 pounds of water. Yesterday's coffee is now today's coffee, right? That makes them number one. This is literally number ones. Yeah, good job. Good job. Anyway, another bit of language that was also controversial that had appeared in the bill and then disappeared from the bill was a clause which would require NASA to not source more than 50% of its launches from one provider. This was clearly an amendment which was targeted at limiting the number of launches that SpaceX would get. Now, to be clear, I strongly believe that NASA needs to very much lean into diversity of launch vehicles. They need to have as much redundancy as possible, and they should also be a catalyst for developing new launch capabilities from young companies. I'm not sure 50% is such a good number. I think a totally arbitrary number that was pulled out of, somewhere. But what became more interesting was a few days later when a certain former NASA administrator praised this amendment and pretty much claimed responsibility for it. Yeah, Jim Bridenstine. We were all such fans of him. He was, dynamic. American rockets, American astronauts, all that stuff. Yeah, we were all on board with that. But now he's, of course, inserting language into bills to try to protect legacy contractors rather than just making the legacy contractors work better. It just feels now that while we were all at one point, well, there was a lot of us who were Bridenstines, and now really the Bridenshine has worn off. And the language has gone, of course. The bill has had this removed because it was kind of poorly thought out, but the Bridenstine will remain. Moving onwards. Also in the news was that there was an Office of the Inspector General report on the human landing systems. And this was published days after those changes. And in fact, they were looking at the old version of the landing plans. But, this was, a lot of these OIG reports are pretty damning, especially things like their report on the construction of the second launch tower, right? Which has been an unmitigated disaster and waste of money. But this one, they said, look, the contracts are largely on budget, right? The two contracts, SpaceX and Blue Origin. Now, they're not on time, but they are largely maintaining their costs. There's also some discrepancies between what SpaceX considers manual control and what NASA considers manual control, right? There's issues with risk, like, for example, the elevator on Starship is considered quite a big risk, right? You can't have a single point of failure there. At this point, they still don't know what would happen, what the plan is for how astronauts get back into Starship if there is a failure in the elevator. There's all these inconsistencies, and NASA is potentially working through it. But I think that, like, what I'm seeing is that, yes, they've identified a bunch of things, and I think that I would like NASA and SpaceX and Blue Origin to be responsive to this. One thing that seemed like a no-brainer was, hey, you know, part of the landing contract, the test, is to show that you can land on the moon and then take off from the moon. But there's no requirement in there to currently test, like, the life support or test that elevator to make sure it can descend to the surface. I think that's a kind of a pretty important thing to do, right? At least, you know, in Blue Origin, they just have to, like, test a ladder. How hard can that be? But elevator and everything else, I'd like to see them actually land Starship on the moon and have, like, a robot step onto the elevator and go out. That would be an ideal world, and I would be here for that. Anyway, moving onwards, on the human spaceflight front, there was one other big piece of news, and that was that Russia got their launch pad fixed. Yes, and this was during the winter. They've only had to delay, like, one progress launch from this pad. Pad 31 had this whole service cabin, if you remember, and it wasn't secured properly during the last Soyuz launch. The crew, of course, went up just fine. They got to the space station, but after the launch, we had a drone camera fly over, and there was a bunch of wreckage in the flame pit. And it turns out that the service cabin, which sits underneath the rocket, allowing them to work on the engines, had not been secured correctly. Now, Russia, thankfully, had some old hardware, which were service cabins for other planned launch pad expansions, which never happened. So they were able to pull this hardware out of storage, and a lot of the work was largely centered around making sure that they could put the stuff up, you know, load the stuff up from underneath, because it wasn't really made to be accessed in this way. But yeah, they did it in a few months. So, you know, congratulations to the team in Russia and Kazakhstan. You worked hard. You worked during the winter. It's cold out there. I'm a lot of respect that you got this done. And I'm glad that we have access restored to the International Space Station from Kazakhstan. Okay, elsewhere, Starlink. Now, this has been an interesting news story. A lot of pilots had got really excited about Starlink, right? The roaming plan that we had was like $100. Oh, no, it was $50 a month. And you had like 100 gigs of traffic if you wanted. And it was working in planes. And people were flying around with it and streaming from the air. And just a couple of weeks ago, the price changed. And it sure feels like a bait and switch. Because, the roaming plan is now limited to 100 miles per hour, which is slower than most aircraft, right? So now if you want to use it on an aircraft up to a speed of 300 miles per hour, it's $250 and you only get 20 gigs of data. So that is a factor of five increase in your cost and a factor of five decrease in the amount of data you get. Sure feels like bait and switch. I thankfully can fly slower than 100 miles per hour, and also I procrastinated and didn't bother getting it. So I might still think about it. Anyway, if you're going to really fast plane above 300 miles an hour, and I know people that have those, and that now costs $1,000. So it's 20 times the previous cost. That's kind of wild. Anyway, that was just an interesting story that sort of fits into my pilot circles. In Japan, iSpace, they've announced their next target is Schrodinger Basin, which is a region near the South Pole, and it's actually on the far side of the moon. This is going to be a mission for NASA's CLIPS program. It's in collaboration with Draper Labs and others, and it's scheduled for no earlier than 2027. Now, because this mission is going to be on the far side of the moon, although at the pole, they're going to need to deploy a couple of relay satellites. So they're going to carry along satellites called Lupine and Alpine to maintain communications. This mission, unlike the previous iSpace Hakuto missions, they're going to be a direct lunar transfer that only takes about 5 days rather than like the 3-month mission which went up near the Lagrange points. So yeah, this Schrodinger Basin is one of the places where we know there's been a volcanic activity, so we should again see different mineralogical materials down there. Speaking of science and minerals, there was a paper that came out that I really liked, which was looking at panspermia. It was very specifically looking at how robust certain microorganisms are when they are being slapped hard by asteroids. So I have a whole video on this. Whole thing about panspermia is that if you have an asteroid that hits a planet and the conditions are right, there may be some small portion of biological material that gets knocked off into space and might live as it transverses across the interplanetary medium and ends up landing perhaps on another planet. So potentially life can move between Mars and Earth. And this has always been something that's sort of theorized. This is like one more bit of evidence that says, yes, it could have happened. It doesn't say that it did happen. It just says that it could well have happened. I have a whole video on that, but I found it fascinating. The other science thing that works on the impact side is 2024 YR4. Now, if you remember, this asteroid was discovered early last year. It was actually discovered in 2024 at Christmas. And early last year, we figured out that it had a good chance of hitting the Earth, but also that it was disappearing off into deep space, and we might not know whether it was going to hit the Earth until it came back in 2028. So fortunately, before it got too far away, we managed to figure out the orbit sufficiently to know that it was going to miss the Earth, but it still had a 4% chance of hitting the moon, which was kind of exciting. But yeah, it then disappeared off into the blackness of space, and no telescope could see it, except somebody figured out that it would pass through JWST's field of view. And so James Webb fired up its sensors, pointed it in the right place, and thankfully, it was close enough to where it was predicted that they were able to get the positions, do new astrometry on it, and get a new orbit. So based on this new data, it's going to miss the moon by about 40,000 kilometers, I believe, is the number that I heard. So that's, oh no, it's going to miss the moon by 40 minutes. Yes, sorry, I'm looking at my notes here. And apparently it's going to be 40 minutes early, which means, despite all my planning, it means that we're not going to be able to hit the moon by changing its orbit. But nevertheless, I might look into that again. So yeah, YR24 is going to pass through the solar system, through the Earth-Moon system in 2032, and it's going to narrowly miss the moon and the Earth. We also got a new measurement from Didymos showing that the DART spacecraft had changed its orbit. And you might think, wait a second, didn't we already know this? Well, sort of. You see, the DART spacecraft back in 2022 hit the asteroid Dimorphos, which is a satellite of Didymos. And within a few days, we were able to see that it had changed the orbit, and we were able to detect this change, showing that Dimorphos had had its orbits changed. Now, seeing that Didymos's orbit changed is a lot harder because it's much bigger and much heavier, but the gravitational link between these two objects meant that we knew it had to happen. So using occultations, they were able to see Dimorphos, or Didymos, sorry, pass in front of stars, therefore accurately get its position measured. They've shown that a long track velocity change as a result of the DART spacecraft not hitting it, but hitting its a satellite, is 11.7 micrometers per second. That is a very, very small change, but it builds up over time, and it was possible to measure this. This also gave us new measurements on the density and mass. Like Didymos is like 2.6 tons per cubic meter, whereas the Dimorphos is closer to 1.454 tons per cubic meter. So that was a cool little mission. European Space Agency, you remember last episode I was talking about the Proba spacecraft, Proba 3, producing really cool artificial eclipses? Well, it's not able to do that right now because they've lost contact with the coronagraph spacecraft. So Proba has two spacecraft. One has the camera, one has the shade, the sunshade, and it looks like the camera, something went wrong. What? It's not clear exactly what happened, but a series of events led to it losing attitude control and not entering safe mode, and it ended up in a position where its solar panel is not pointed at the sun. Therefore, it ran out of power. Now, the two spacecraft are still orbiting together, and there is some like optical imaging capability, I believe, on the Occulter spacecraft. So it could, in theory, fly close and get some information. But ideally, they do want these two spacecraft to remain close to each other because you don't want their orbits to change too much because they have to ultimately stay in formation, assuming these things get fixed. We haven't had any update on this. The last update we got was a few days ago, but that's like 3 weeks after the actual failure. Closer to Earth, there was a story that came out of Ellie in space. Do you remember Ellie? She interviewed me and we went hiking up Mountaineer Me to a crash site. I like her. But she actually did some like original research and noticed that the Zero-G aircraft for Zero-G Industries hasn't been flying for the last 9 months. It moved on June 30th last year. It flew over to like a place in Alabama, presumably to get some maintenance done, and it hasn't flown since. Now, there's been stories about how its certification has been revoked and whatever. These are all comments that are being stated without any evidence to support them. I've also heard that it was supposed to be doing a maintenance, like, tear down, basically a high-level maintenance servicing program, and something happened which perhaps damaged the wing. And regardless, this has left the US without any zero-G parabolic flight capabilities. NASA has got a proposal being put together looking for a new provider which will exclusively serve NASA. It's not clear that if this provider comes online that they will continue to offer services to private citizens such as me who get to float around in zero-G. For now, what we are seeing is there's a lot of US-based scientists who have enough links to the European Space Agency to get their experiments flown over there. The other providers, by the way, of zero-G capability have both stopped flying as well. Blue Origin have stopped their new Shepard flights, and Virgin Galactic have also stopped they're currently not flying their Spaceship 2. That may come back later this year. It would be very nice. But for now, US has no real long-duration zero-G capability beyond flying it in space. SpaceX, they are moving forward on their test campaign for the next Starship flight. If you remember, I think about 6 weeks ago, Elon said that it would be 6 weeks to the next flight. He just came online and said, it'll be 4 weeks. So we are performing like Elon's paradox as we shrink the numbers down towards zero. I hope we get to fly in April. I hope that it's not too close to the Artemis, so there's a chance for me to actually get out there. But yeah, they took Ship 39 out to Masses. They did some cryo testing out there. It looks like it's good. Booster 19 was taken out of the factory, rolled down to the launch pad onto pad 2, which is of course completely remodeled now with a proper flame diverter, shorter chopsticks, and we see this in the new booster, the new Mark 3 or Model 3 or whatever, V3 booster. It only has 3 grid fins. They are much larger. It doesn't have the support pins. The booster is picked up directly by the grid fins now. So they did a cryo test on that. They loaded it all the way up. It didn't have a full complement of V3 Raptor engines on there, but they did actually fill it up, at least the full oxygen tank and a small fuel tank, and presuming that that was actually nitrogen, it was just a cryo test, although they did do things like test the detonation suppression system as well. As of right now, it got lifted back off and it's been put elsewhere. We think it might roll back. It is interesting that the old launch pad, because it was a flat area below, they could actually just roll in like with a cherry picker and get under the thing if they needed to. I'm not clear that they can do that right now with the new flame diverter. But another interesting thing about Starship that came out is Voyager Technologies. They are launching their Starlab space station, and a while back they said that they had identified or secured their launch provider would be SpaceX with the Super Heavy. That would be the only thing that could handle this big chunk of space hardware. And during a recent financial filing, it was stated that the launch would cost $90 million. And so now people are drawing a line between Starship Super Heavy and this to say that's what it's going to cost to launch on Starship and Super Heavy. I'm not 100% convinced. It's very possible that in the intervening months that a different launch provider has been identified. Blue Origin's New Glenn might hypothetically do this. Regardless, this is an interesting data point because, hey, if you put 100 people on a Starship because you want to do zero-G stunts in low Earth orbit, that's going to be $900,000 each. So it's not exactly democratizing space to the level we would like. And certainly it's not at a cost level which would be compatible with these grand plans of data centers for Starlink. We have a new X plane. DARPA announced the X-76 to be built by Bell. And this is going to be something like a high-speed version of the Osprey. It's going to have jet engines in the fuselage at the back, and it looks like it has turboprops on the wing tips. I can't quite figure it out because the blades fold inwards, so they can actually feather these blades and fold them back completely and put these in a forward orientation so that it can fly at high speed, like, you know, 300 plus knots. I'm not sure how fast it's supposed to be. It does show that it has a straight wing, so obviously if it can't be that fast that a swept wing would make a difference. But yeah, I am fascinated to see if this thing actually works and takes off, because it's always cool to see new X-planes involved. In the private world, Hermes, you might remember they are working on a Mach 5, you know, combined cycle turbine and ramjet system. They have their Quarter Horse 2.1 Mark aircraft. They've just got their necessary special airworthiness certificate, you know, for experimental aircraft from the FAA. So they will be doing flight testing on their hardware. I'm not sure how fast it's going to be flying. It's probably not going up to Mach 5 just yet. They're really just looking at the aerodynamics of this thing to make sure that it's controllable at low speed. And then they can start working on their mass distribution and other things like that. HEO Space published a really cool image of AST Space Mobile's antenna in space. This is the largest commercial communications antenna in orbit. And a lot of people saw this and they instantly said, you know what? That looks like a Star Destroyer. It led to a whole thread of people talking about, you know, the new order and everything. And very specifically, I linked to, Jared's love for the Empire, let's say. When he flies, he has the Imperial logo on his helmet. So I figured if anyone's going to put a Star Destroyer in Earth orbit, he would be involved. A few days ago, one of NASA's Van Allen probes deorbited over the Pacific. These are like 1,323 pounds, you know, 600 kilograms. There's a pair of satellites which were launched back in 2012. And they were in these highly eccentric orbits that came down close to the Earth and then went out to about 20,000 miles. And by doing that, they would pass through the Van Allen belt. Now, I think they'd stopped their mission some time back and been slowly decaying. And this one in particular, you know, just the alignment of the moon and the sun and tidal forces had pushed its perigee down enough that it ended up deorbiting. Now, the other one, it's still orbiting fine and is expected to continue orbiting for years still. Blue Origin announced an interesting collaboration. Talking about their Blue Ring spacecraft. It's to create the Near-Earth Object Hunter mission with JPL. And this is basically, it's more a concept. It's not something that's necessarily funded as far as I understand it, but NEO Hunter is supposed to test multiple mechanisms for asteroid deflection, right? So they're using like ion beam deflection where they sit close to the asteroid and zap it with an ion beam, which releases energy and it kicks off debris and you create like a jet of material coming off. And the other way they're going to do it is swing it around and come in fast and smack another asteroid at higher speed. The whole point is, you know, demonstrating multiple ways of changing asteroid orbits, proactively having like the capability of altering an asteroid's orbit should it be needed in the future. In China, there was some new like details on their Tianwen-3 mission. They claim that the mission development is progressing on schedule and that they expect to be launching in 2028. This is going to be China's plan to return samples from Mars. So this is going to be a single mission, which is going to have multiple vehicles involved. It's going to be just like their lunar sample return, but obviously going to Mars, and that means a much bigger launch vehicle launching from Mars. So at the rate things are going, China's almost certainly going to get samples back from Mars before NASA, before the US. And, you know, that's unfortunate because, you know, Perseverance, obviously, they had this budget for a rover. They went out, they thought, we will build the perfect sample selection system because we know that we're going to keep getting money. Turns out that they didn't continue to get money, and now we have all these carefully curated samples sitting on the surface of Mars. China's going to land, they're going to drill a core, they're going to get amazing samples. They're only going to get maybe one or two very limited selection of samples, but they will be the first and they will tell us all sorts of amazing things while Perseverance's samples just sit on the surface of Mars waiting for the US to figure out what it's doing. Also in China, Landspace, they showed off their 220-ton full flow stage combustion thrust Methalox engine. That sounds familiar. They performed a long-duration burn. Apparently, they've fired it over 100 times at this point. It's the BF-class engine that started development back in May of last year. So, yeah, they're looking to build a bigger system. And from high-profile or high-performance full-flow stage combustion engines down to water rockets. You remember Arca Space? Yeah, they have all sorts of different ideas. They seem to have thrown a bunch of different space ideas around. Well, we're wondering if they're dead because suddenly all their web domains are non-existent. Even their fashion domain, because they said, hey, let's do aerospace fashion. That'll get a bunch of clicks. Yeah, that appears to be dead. They, if you remember, they were building their eco rocket. They were saying that, you know, if you build enough cores, you can use high pressure water to and high temperature water to launch something into orbit. And we figured out that we need many, many more stages. It was going to be like a, as we say, an asparagus staging monster. And actually, I remember they posted a response to me when I criticized them, which corrected a number of things I'd got wrong, but I did find it was funny that they, at one point, they were trying to say, listen, you overestimated the performance of a rocket. It's much worse. And they were trying to claim some sort of victory through that. Regardless, I don't know what's going on with Dmitry et al. And Arca, but I do know that the last thing they were doing was building some Arca Board 2, which was a monster red eVTOL that you flew laying down. I don't know what's going on there. Anyway, that is, I think, all the news that I can remember. This has been quite a long one to record. In the next few days, well, a lot of fans are getting excited to see what Project Hail Mary looks like in the movie theatres. And, of course, I'm off to South by Southwest to play a DJ set at this weekend in Austin. It'll be more of my space videos and other stuff with a whole bunch of cool space people. Maybe I'll see you there. I'm Scott Manley. Fly safe.